September, though the leaves were just turning yellow and some children were throwing a football in a vacant lot. Gerald had to stay home that night. He had caught a cold, and since the air was chilly, my mother thought he should not go out. So Jenner and I went without him. I remember we promised to bring him back some of his favorite food, beef liver, if we could find any. We took our usual route to the market, not along the streets, but through the narrow walkways between the buildings, mostly commercial warehouses and garages that bordered the square. As we walked, we were joined by more rats. At that time of day, they converged on the marketplace from all directions. When we reached the square, I noticed that there was a white truck of an odd square shape parked on the street bordering it, perhaps a block away. I say I noticed it. I did not pay any particular attention to it, for trucks were common enough in that part of town. But if I had, I would have noticed that printed on each side of it were four small letters. N-I-M-H. I would not have known what they were, of course, for at that time neither I nor any of the other rats knew how to read. It was growing dark when we reached the market, but through the dusk we could see that there was an unusually large supply of food, a great mound of it, near the center of the square, away from the roofed-over portion. I suppose that should have served as warning, but it didn't. I remember Jenner's saying, "They must have had a really busy day." And we ran joyfully toward the pile, along with several dozen other rats. Just as we reached the food, it happened. All around us, suddenly, there was shouting. Bright, blinding searchlights flashed on, aimed at us and at the mound of food, so that when we tried to run away from it, we could not see where we were going. Between and behind the lights there were shadows moving swiftly, and as they came toward us I could see that they were men. Men in white uniforms carrying nets, round nets with long handles. "Look out!" cried Jenner. "They're trying to catch us!" He darted in one direction, I in another, and I lost sight of him. We all ran, straight toward the men with the nets. There was no other way to run. They had us encircled. The nets flailed down, scooped, flailed again. I suppose some rats made it through, slipping between the men and past the lights. I felt a swish. A net just missed me. I turned and ran back toward the mound, thinking I might hide myself in it. But then came another swish, and that time I felt the enveloping fibers fall over me. They entangled my legs, then my neck. I was lifted from the ground along with three other rats, and the net closed around us. In the cage. Mrs. Frisbee said, "But why did they want to catch you? And how did you ever get away again?" "At first," said Nicodemus, "I thought it must be because they didn't like our stealing the food. And yet you could hardly even call it stealing. It was waste food, and all they did with it was haul it away to the city incinerator. So what harm if we ate some of it? Of course, there are people who just dislike rats, whether they're doing any harm or not." "And mice, too," said Mrs. Frisbee. "True," said Nicodemus. "Though not so much as rats, I think. Anyway, that wasn't the reason at all. But what the real reason was, I didn't find out for a while. As to getting away, that too didn't happen until much later. No, I was firmly and inextricably caught, snared in the net and helpless," Nicodemus continued. "When the man who held it saw that he had four rats, he pulled a drawstring that closed it up. He put the net down and picked up another, an empty one. He moved on into the square, leaving us to lie there. I tried gnawing my way out, but the strands were made of some kind of plastic, as hard as wire. The noise and movement began to die down eventually, I suppose the rats in the square had all either been caught or had escaped. I heard one man call to another, "I guess that's a lot." Someone else was turning a light this way and that, searching the rest of the market area. Not a one to be seen. We could hide and wait for another wave. There won't be another wave, not tonight. Probably not for 4 or 5 nights. Word gets around.
You mean they communicate?
A third voice.
You bet they communicate. And the next time they do come, you can be sure they'll case the place carefully.
We were lucky. These rats hadn't been bothered for years. They'd grown careless.
How many did the lab order?
Someone was turning out the lights one at a time.
5 dozen. How many have we got?
About that. Maybe more.
Let's load the truck.
In a minute or so, I felt myself being lifted up. And swinging back and forth in the net, I was carried with my 3 companions to the white truck I had seen earlier. Its back doors were open, and it was lighted inside. I could see that its whole interior was a large wire cage. Into this our net was thrust. The man then opened the drawstring, and we were dumped onto the floor, which was covered with sawdust. The other nets were emptied, one at a time, the same way. And in a few minutes there was a good-sized crowd of us on the floor. All more or less dazed, and all, if I was typical, terrified. The cage was locked, the doors clanged shut, and the lights went out. I heard the truck motor start. A second later, the floor lurched beneath me. We were moving. Where were they taking us? For what purpose? Then, in the dark, I heard a voice beside me.
Nicodemus?
It was Jenner.
You can imagine how glad I was to hear him.
But I was sorry, too.
Jenner, I thought maybe you got away.
I was in the last net. I thought I saw you across the floor. Where are we going?
I don't know.
What's a lab?
A laboratory.
Yes, but what is it?
I don't know. I've just heard the word somewhere.
Well, I think that's where we're going, whatever it is. The truck rumbled along through the dark, over bumpy streets at first, and then at a higher speed over a smooth highway. There were no windows in the back, so it was impossible to see where we were going. Not that I would have known anyway, never before having been more than 6 blocks from home. I think we drove for about 2 hours, but it might have been less, before the truck slowed and turned, and finally came to a stop. The back doors were opened again, and through the wire wall of the cage I saw that we had come to a building, very modern, of white cement and glass. It was square and big, about 10 stories tall. Night had fallen, and most of its windows were dark, but the platform to which our truck drove us was lighted, and there were people waiting for us. A door opened, and 3 men came out. One of them pushed a cart, a hand truck piled with small wire cages. The man beside him was dressed in a heavy coat, boots, and thick leather gloves. The third man wore heavy horn-rimmed glasses and a white coat. He was obviously the leader. The men from the truck, the ones who had caught us, now joined the men from the building.
"How many did you get?" asked the man in the white coat.
"Hard to count. They keep moving around.
But I make it between 60 and 70.
"Good. Any trouble?"
"No. It was easy. They acted almost tame."
"I hope not. I've got enough tame ones."
"Oh, they're lively enough. And they look healthy.
Let's get them out."
The man with the gloves and the boots then donned a wire face mask as well and climbed in among us. He opened a small sliding trapdoor at the back of our cage. A man outside held one of the small cages up to the opening, and one at a time we were pushed out into our individual little prisons. A few of the rats snarled and tried to bite. I did not. And neither did Jenner. It was too obviously futile. When it was finished, the man in the white coat said, 63, good work. A man from the truck said, thanks, Dr. Schultz. And we were racked on the hand truck and wheeled into the building. Dr. Schultz. I didn't know it then, but I was to be his prisoner and his pupil for the next 3 years. We spent the rest of that night in a long white room. It was, in fact, a laboratory, with a lot of equipment at one end that I didn't understand at all then. Bottles and shiny metal things and black boxes with wires trailing from them. But our end held only rows of cages on shelves, each cage with a tag on it and each separated from its neighbors by wooden partitions on both sides. Someone came around with a stack of small jars and fastened one to my cage. A little pipe led through the bars like a sipping straw, drinking water. Then the lights were dimmed and we were left alone. That cage was my home for a long time. It was not uncomfortable. It had a floor of some kind of plastic, medium soft and warm to the touch, with wire walls and ceiling. It was airy enough. Yet just the fact that it was a cage made it horrible. I would always run where I wanted, could go three hops forward, three hops back again, and that was all. But worse was the dreadful feeling, I know we all had it, that we were completely at the mercy of someone we knew not at all, for some purpose we couldn't guess. What were their plans for us? As it turned out, the uncertainty itself was the worst suffering we had to undergo. We were treated well enough, except for some very small, very quick flashes of pain, which were part of our training. And we were always well fed, though the food, scientifically compiled pellets, was not what you'd call delicious. But, of course, we didn't know that when we arrived. And I doubt that any of us got much sleep that first night. I know I didn't. So, in a way, it was a relief when early the next morning the lights snapped on and Dr. Schultz entered. There were two other people with him, a young man and a young woman. Like him, they were dressed in white laboratory coats. He was talking to them as they entered the room and walked toward our cages. Three groups, 20 for training on injection series A, 20 on series B. And that will leave 23 for the control group. They get no injections at all, except to keep the test exactly even, we will prick them with a plain needle. Let's call the groups A, B, and C for control. Tag them and number them A1 through A20, B1 through B20, and so on. Number the cages the same way, and keep each rat in the same cage throughout. Diet will be the same for all. When do we start the injections? As soon as we're through with the tagging. We'll do that now. George, you number the tags and the cages. Julie, you tie them on. I'll hold. So the young woman's name was Julie. The young man was George. They all put gloves on, long, tough plastic ones that came to their elbows. One by one, we were taken from our cages, held gently but firmly by Dr. Schultz, while Julie fastened around each of our necks a narrow ribbon of yellow plastic bearing a number. I learned eventually that mine was number A10. They were kind, especially Julie. I remember that when one rat was being tagged, she looked at it and said, "Poor little thing, he's frightened. Look how he's trembling." "What kind of biologist are you?" said Dr. Schultz. "The poor little thing is a she, not a he." When my turn came, the door of my cage slid open just enough for Dr. Schultz to put his gloved hand through. I cowered to the back of the cage, which was just what he expected me to do. One hand pressed me flat against the wire wall. Then his fingers gripped my shoulders. The other hand held my head just behind the ears, and I was powerless. I was lifted from the cage and felt the plastic collar clipped around my neck. I was back inside, with the door closed, in less than a minute. The collar was not tight,
But by no amount of tugging, twisting, or shaking was I ever able to get it off. I watched through the wire front of my cage as the others were caught and tagged. About 6 cages down from me, on the same shelf, I saw them put a collar on Jenner. But once he was back in his cage, I could see him no longer. A little later in the morning, they came around again, this time pushing a table on wheels. It was loaded with a bottle of some clear liquid, a long rack of sharp needles, and a plunger. Once more, I was lifted from the cage. This time George did the holding while Dr. Schultz fastened one of the needles to the plunger. I felt a sharp pain in my hip. Then it was over. We all got used to that, for from then on we got injections at least twice a week. What they were injecting and why, I did not know. Yet for 20 of us, those injections were to change our whole lives. The Maze. During the days that followed, our lives fell into a pattern, and the reason for our captivity gradually became clear. Dr. Schultz was a neurologist, that is, an expert on brains, nerves, intelligence, and how people learn things. He hoped, by experimenting on us, to find out whether certain injections could help us to learn more and faster. The two younger people working with him, George and Julie, were graduate students in biology. Watch always, he told them, for signs of improvement, faster learning, quicker reaction in group A as compared to group B, and both as compared to the control group. My own training began on the day after the first injections. It was George who did it. I suppose Julie and Dr. Schultz were doing the same test on other rats. He took my cage from the shelf and carried it to another room, similar to the first one but with more equipment in it and no shelves of cages. He placed the cage in a slot against a wall, slid open the end, opened a matching door in the wall, and I was free. Or so I thought. The small doorway in the wall led into a short corridor, which opened, or seemed to, directly onto a green lawn. I could see it clearly, and behind it some bushes, and behind them a street. All outdoors, and nothing but air between me and them. Furthermore, I could smell the fresh outdoor breeze blowing in. Were they letting me go? I made a dash toward the open end of the corridor, and then jumped back. I could not go on. About 2 feet from my cage, still open behind me, there was something dreadfully wrong with the floor. When I touched my feet to it, a terrible prickling feeling came over my skin. My muscles cramped, my eyes blurred, and I got instantly dizzy. I never got used to that feeling. No one ever does. But I did experience it many times, and eventually learned what it was. Electric shock. It's not exactly a pain, but it is unbearable. Yet I was in a frenzy to reach that open lawn, to run for the bushes, to get away from the cage. I tried again, and jumped back again. No use. Then I saw, leading off to the left, another corridor. I had not noticed it at first because I had been looking so eagerly at the open end of the one I was in. The second one seemed to stop about 5 feet away in a blank wall. Yet there was light there. It must turn a corner. I ran down it cautiously, not trusting the floor. At the end it turned right, and there was the lawn again, another opening. I got closer that time, then just as I thought I was going to make it, another shock. I pulled back and saw that there was still another corridor leading off to the right. Again I ran, again I saw the open escape hole, and again I was stopped by shock. This was repeated over and over, yet each time I seemed to get a little closer to freedom. But when I finally reached it and the grass was only a step away,
A wire wall snapped down in front of me, another behind me. The ceiling opened above me, and a gloved hand reached in and picked me up. A voice said, 4:37. It was George. I had, after all my running through the corridors, emerged into a trap only a few feet from where I had started. And through a concealed opening up above, George had been watching everything I did. I had been in what is called a maze, a device to test intelligence and memory. I was put in it many times again, and so were the others. The second time I got through it a little faster because I remembered, to some extent, which corridors had electric floors and which did not. The third time I was still faster. And after each trial, George, or sometimes Julie, sometimes Dr. Schultz, would write down how long it took. You might ask, why would I bother to run through it at all if I knew it was only a trick? The answer is, I couldn't help it. When you've lived in a cage, you can't bear not to run, even if what you're running toward is an illusion. There were more injections and other kinds of tests, and some of these were more important than the maze, because the maze was designed only to find out how quickly we could learn, while some of the others actually taught us things, or at least led up to actual teaching. One was what Dr. Schultz called shape recognition. We would be put into a small room with three doors leading out, one round, one square, and one triangular. These doors were on hinges with springs that held them shut. But they were easy to push open, and each door led into another room with three more doors, like the first one. But the trick was this. If you went through the wrong door, the room you entered had an electric floor, and you got a shock. So you had to learn. In the first room, you used the round door, second room, triangle, and so on. All of these activities helped to pass the time, and the weeks went by quickly, but they did not lessen our longing to get away. I wished for my old home in the storm sewer. I wished I could see my mother and father, and run with my brother to the marketplace. I know all the others felt the same way, yet it seemed a hopeless thing. Still, there was one rat who decided to try it anyway. It was a young rat, probably the youngest of all that had been caught, and by chance he was in the cage next to mine. I might mention that, like Jenner and me, he was in the group Dr. Schultz called A. His name was Justin. It was late one night that I heard him calling to me, speaking softly, around the wooden partition between our cages. Those partitions generally kept all of us from getting to know each other as well as we might have done, and discouraged us from talking much to one another. It was quite hard to hear around them, and of course you could never see the one you were talking to. I think Dr. Schultz had purposely had them made of some soundproof material. But you could hear, if you and your neighbor got in the corners of the cages nearest each other, and spoke out through the wire front. Nicodemus? Yes. I went over to the corner. How long have we been here? You mean since the beginning? Since we were caught? Yes. I don't know. Several months, I think, but I have no way to keep track. I know. I don't either. Do you suppose it's winter outside now? Probably. Or late fall. It'll be cold. But not in here. No. But I'm going to try to get out. Get out? But how? Your cage is shut. Tomorrow we get injections, so they'll open it. When they do, I'm going to run. Run where? I don't know. At least I'll get a look around. There might be some way out. What can I lose? You might get hurt. I don't think so. Anyway, they won't hurt me. By they, he meant Dr. Schultz and the other two.
He added confidently, "All those shots, all the time they've spent, we're too valuable to them now. They'll be careful." That idea had not occurred to me before. But when I thought about it, I decided he was right. Dr. Schultz, Julie, and George had spent most of their working hours with us for months. They could not afford to let any harm come to us. On the other hand, neither could they afford to allow any of us to escape. Justin made his attempt the next morning. And it did cause a certain amount of excitement, but not at all what we expected. It was Julie who opened Justin's cage with a hypodermic in her hand. Justin was out with a mighty leap, hit the floor about 4 feet down, with a thump, shook himself, and ran, disappearing from my view, heading toward the other end of the room. Julie seemed not at all alarmed. She calmly placed the needle on a shelf, then walked to the door of the laboratory and pushed a button on the wall near it. A red light came on over the door. She picked up a notebook and pencil from a desk near the door and followed Justin out of my sight. A few minutes later, Dr. Schultz and George entered. They opened the door cautiously and closed it behind them. "The outer door is shut, too," said Dr. Schultz. "Where is it?" "Down here," said Julie, inspecting the air ducts. "Really? Which one is it?" "It's one of the A group, just as you expected. Number 9. I'm keeping notes on it." Obviously, the red light was some kind of a warning signal, both outside the door and in. Laboratory animal at large. And not only had Dr. Schultz known one of us was out, but he had expected it to happen. "A few days sooner than I thought," he was saying, "but so much the better. Do you realize?" "Look," said Julie. "He's doing the whole baseboard, but he's studying the windows, too. See how he steps back to look up?" "Of course," said Dr. Schultz. "And at the same time, he's watching us, too. Can't you see?" "He's pretty cool about it," said George. "Can you imagine one of the lab rats doing that? Or even one of the controls? We've got to try to grasp what we have on our hands. The A group is now 300% ahead of the control group in learning and getting smarter all the time. B group is only 20% ahead. It's the new DNA that's doing it. We have a real breakthrough. And since it is DNA, we may very well have a true mutation, a brand new species of rat. But we've got to be careful with it. I think we should go ahead now with the next injection series." "The steroids?" Whatever that meant. "Yes. It may slow them up a little, though I doubt it. But even if it does, it will be worth it, because I'm betting it will increase their lifespan by double, at least. Maybe more. Maybe much more." "Look," said Julie. "A9 has made a discovery. He's found the mice." George said, "See how he's studying them?" "Probably," said Dr. Schultz wryly. "He's wondering if they're ready for their steroid injections, too. As a matter of fact, I think the G group is. They're doing almost as well as A group." "Should I get the net and put him back?" George asked. "I doubt that you'll need it," Dr. Schultz said, "now that he's learned he can't get out." But they were underestimating Justin. He had learned no such thing. A lesson in reading. Of course, Justin did not escape that day, nor even that year. When they, Julie, put on a glove and went to pick him up, he submitted, meekly enough, and in a short time he was back in his cage. Yet he had learned some things. He had, as Julie noticed, examined the air ducts, the openings along the wall through which warm air flowed in winter, cool air in summer, and he had studied the windows. Mainly, he had learned that he could, occasionally at least, jump from his cage and wander around without incurring any anger or injury. All of this eventually was important, for it was Justin, along with Jenner, who finally figured out how to get away.
I had a part in it, too, but all that came later. I won't go into details about the rest of our training, except for one part of it that was the most useful of all. But in general, during the months that followed, two things were happening. First, we were learning more than any rats ever had before, and were becoming more intelligent than any rats had ever been. The second thing could be considered, from some points of view, even more important, and certainly more astonishing than the first. Dr. Schultz, you will recall, had said that the new series of injections might increase our lifespan by double or more. Yet even he was not prepared for what happened. Perhaps it was the odd combination of both types of injections working together. I don't know, and neither did he. But the result was that, as far as he could detect, in the A group, the aging process seemed to stop almost completely. For example, during the years we were in the laboratory, most of the rats in the control group grew old and sickly, and finally died. So did those in B group, for though they were getting injections too, the formula was not the same as ours. But among the 20 of us in A group, no one could see any signs that we were growing older at all. Apparently, though we seldom saw them, the same thing was happening with the G group, the mice who were getting the same injections we were. Dr. Schultz was greatly excited about this. The short lifespan has always been a prime limiting factor in education, he told George and Julie. If we can double it and speed up the learning process at the same time, the possibilities are enormous. Double it! Even now, years later, years after the injections were stopped, we seem scarcely any older than we were then. We could not detect either of these things ourselves. That is, we didn't feel any different. And since we had no contact with the other groups, we had no basis for comparison. All we had to go by was what Dr. Schultz said. He and the others were preparing a research paper about us to be published in some scientific journal. So each morning, he dictated the results of the previous day's tests into a tape recorder. We heard all of it, though there was a lot of technical stuff we couldn't understand, especially at first. Until the paper was published, he kept reminding George and Julie of this. The whole experiment was to be kept secret. The one important phase of training began one day after weeks of really hard work at the shape recognition that I mentioned before. But this was different. For the first time, they used sounds along with the shapes, and pictures, real pictures we could recognize. For example, one of the first and simplest of these exercises was a picture, a clear photograph, of a rat. I suppose they felt sure we would know what that was. This picture was shown on a screen, with a light behind it. Then, after I had looked at the picture and recognized it, a shape flashed on the screen under it, a sort of half-circle and two straight lines, not like anything I had seen before. Then the voice began. R. 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 It was Julie's voice, speaking very clearly, but it had a tinny sound. It was a record. After repeating R a dozen times or so, that particular shape disappeared and another one came on the screen, still under the picture of the rat. It was a triangle with legs on it, and Julie's voice began again. A. 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 When that shape disappeared, a third one came on the screen. This one was a cross. Julie's voice said, T. 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 Then all three shapes appeared at once, and the record said, R. A. T. Rat. You would probably have recognized what was going on. They were teaching us to read. The symbols under the picture were the letters R. A-T. But the idea did not become clear to me, nor to any of us, for quite a long time, because, of course, we didn't know what reading was. Oh, we learned to recognize the shapes easily enough, and when I saw the rat picture, I knew straight away what symbols would appear beneath it. In the same way, when the picture showed a cat, I knew the same shapes would appear, except the first one would be a half circle, and Julie's voice would repeat, "See, see, see." I even learned that when the photograph showed not one but several rats, a fourth shape would appear under it, a snaky line, and the sound with that one was S, S, S. But as to what all this was for, none of us had any inkling. It was Jenner who finally figured it out. By this time we had developed a sort of system of communication, a simple enough thing, just passing spoken messages from one cage to the next, like passing notes in school. Justin, who was still next to me, called to me one day. "Message for Nicodemus from Jenner. He says important." "All right," I said. "What's the message?" "Look at the shapes on the wall next to the door. He says to look carefully." My cage, like Jenner's and those of the rest of A group, was close enough to the door so I could see what he meant. Near the doorway there was a large square piece of white cardboard fastened to the wall, a sign. It was covered with an assortment of black markings, to which I had never paid any attention, though they had been there ever since we arrived. Now, for the first time, I looked at them carefully, and I grasped what Jenner had discovered. The top line of black marks on the wall were instantly familiar. R-A-T-S. As soon as I saw them, I thought of the picture that went with them. And as soon as I did that, I was, for the first time, reading. Because, of course, that's what reading is, using symbols to suggest a picture or an idea. From that time on, it gradually became clear to me what all these lessons were for. And once I understood the idea, I was eager to learn more. I could scarcely wait for the next lesson, and the next. The whole concept of reading was, to me at least, fascinating. I remember how proud I was when, months later, I was able to read and understand that whole sign. I read it hundreds of times, and I'll never forget it. Rats may not be removed from the laboratory without written permission. And at the bottom, in smaller letters, the word NIM. But then a puzzling thing came up, a thing we're still not sure about even now. Apparently Dr. Schultz, who was running the lessons, did not realize how well they were succeeding. He continued the training, with new words and new pictures every day. But the fact is, once we had grasped the idea and learned the different sounds each letter stood for, we leaped way ahead of him. I remember well, during one of the lessons, looking at a picture of a tree. Under it the letters flashed on, T-R-E-E. But in the photograph, though the tree was in the foreground, there was a building in the background, and a sign near it. I scarcely glanced at tree, but concentrated instead on reading the sign. It said, NIM, private parking by permit only. Reserved for doctors and staff, no visitor parking. The building behind it, tall and white, looked very much like the building we were in. I'm sure Dr. Schultz had plans for testing our reading ability. I could even guess from the words he was teaching us what the tests were going to be like. For example, he taught us left, right, door, food, open, and so on. It was not hard to imagine the test. I would be placed in one chamber, my food in another. There would be two doors and a sign saying, "For food, open door at right," or something like that. Then if all of us, moved unerringly toward the proper door, he would know we understood the sign. As I said, I'm sure he planned to do this, but apparently he did not think we were ready for it yet. I think maybe he was even a little afraid to try it, because if he did it too soon, or if for any other reason it didn't work, his experiment would be a failure. He wanted to be sure, and his caution was his undoing. Justin announced one evening around the partition, "I'm going to get out of my cage tonight and wander around a bit." "How can you? It's locked." "Yes, but did you notice along the bottom edge there's a printed strip?" I had not noticed it. I should perhaps explain that when Dr. Schultz and the others opened our cages, we could never quite see how they did it. They manipulated something under the plastic floor, something we couldn't see. What does it say? I've been trying to read it the last three times they brought me back from training. It's very small print, but I think I've finally made it out. It says, to release door, pull knob forward and slide right. Knob? Under the floor, about an inch back, there's a metal thing just in front of the shelf. I think that's the knob, and I think I can reach it through the wire. Anyway, I'm going to try. Now? Not until they close up. Closing up was a ritual Dr. Schultz, George, and Julie went through each night. For about an hour they sat at their desks, wrote notes in books, filed papers in cabinets, and finally locked the cabinets. Then they checked all the cages, dimmed the lights, locked the doors, and went home, leaving us alone in the still laboratory. About half an hour after they left that night, Justin said, "I'm going to try now." I heard a scuffling noise, a click and scrape of metal, and in a matter of seconds I saw his door swing open. It was as simple as that, when you could read. "Wait," I said. "What's the matter? If you jump down, you won't be able to get back in. Then they'll know." I thought of that. I'm not going to jump down. I'm going to climb up the outside of the cage. It's easy. I've climbed up the inside 1,000 times. Above these cages, there's another shelf, and it's empty. I'm going to walk along there and see what I can see. I think there's a way to climb to the floor and up again. Why don't I go with you? My door would open the same way as his. Better not this time, don't you think? If something goes wrong and I can't get back, they'll say, "It's just A9 again." But if two of us are found outside, they'll take it seriously. They might put new locks on the cages. He was right, and you can see that already we both had the same idea in mind, that this might be the first step toward escape for all of us. The air ducts. And so it was. By teaching us how to read, they had taught us how to get away. Justin climbed easily up the open door of his cage and vanished over the top with a flick of his tail. He came back an hour later, greatly excited and full of information. Yet it was typical of Justin that even excited as he was, he stayed calm. He thought clearly. He climbed down the front of my cage rather than his own and spoke softly. We both assumed that by now the other rats were asleep. "Nicodemus, come on out. I'll show you how." He directed me as I reached through the wire bars of the door and felt beneath it. I found the small metal knob, slid it forward and sideward, and felt the door swing loose against my shoulder. I followed him up the side of the cage to the shelf above. There we stopped. It was the first time I had met Justin face to face. He said, "It's better talking here than around that partition." "Yes. Did you get down?" "Yes. How did you get back up?" "At the end of this shelf there's a big cabinet. They keep the mouse cages in it. It has wire mesh doors. You can climb up and down them like a ladder." "Of course," I said. "I remember now." I had seen that cabinet many times when my cage was carried past it. For some reason, perhaps because they were smaller, the mice were kept in cages within a cage. Justin said, "Nicodemus, I think I've found the way to get out." "You have? How?" "At each end of the room, there's an opening in the baseboard at the bottom of the wall. Air blows in through one of them and out the other. Each one has a metal grid covering it, and on the grid, there's a sign that says, 'Lift to adjust airflow.' I lifted one of them. It hangs on hinges, like a trap door. Behind it, there is a thing like a metal window. When you slide it wide open, more air blows in. But the main thing is, it's easily big enough to walk through and get out."
"But what's on the other side? Where does it lead?"
On the other side there's a duct, a thing like a square metal pipe, built right into the wall. I walked along it, not very far, but I can figure out where it must go. There's bound to be a duct like it leading to every room in the building, and they must all branch off one main central pipe, and that one has to lead somewhere to the outside, because that's where our air comes from. That's why they never open the windows. I don't think those windows can open. He was right, of course. The building had central air conditioning. What we had to do was find the main air shaft and explore it. There would have to be an intake at one end and an outlet at the other. But that was easier said than done. And before it was done, there were questions to be answered. What about the rest of the rats? There were 20 of us in the laboratory, and we had to let the others know. So, one by one, we woke them and showed them how to open their cages. It was an odd assembly that gathered that night, under the dimmed lights in the echoing laboratory, on the shelf where Justin and I had talked. We all knew each other, in a way, from the passing of messages over the preceding months. Yet, except for Jenner and me, none of us had ever really met. We were strangers, though, as you can imagine, it did not take long for us to develop a feeling of comradeship, for we 20 were alone in a strange world. Just how alone and how strange, none of us really understood at first. Yet, in a way, we sensed it from the beginning. The group looked to me as leader, probably because it was Justin and I who first set them free, and because Justin was obviously younger than I. We did not attempt to leave that night, but went together and looked at the metal grid Justin had discovered, and made plans for exploring the air ducts. Jenner was astute at that sort of thing. He could foresee problems. With a vent like this leading to every room, he said, it will be easy to get lost. When we explore, we're going to need some way of finding our way back here. Why should we come back? Someone asked. Because it may take more than one night to find the way out. If it does, whoever is doing the exploring must be back in his cage by morning, otherwise Dr. Schultz will find out. Jenner was right. It took us about a week. What we did, after some more discussion, was to find some equipment. First, a large spool of thread in one of the cabinets, where some of us had seen Julie place it one day. Second, a screwdriver that was kept on a shelf near the electric equipment, because, as Jenner pointed out, there would probably be a screen over the end of the air shaft to keep out debris, and we might have to pry it loose. What we really needed was a light, for the ducts, at night, were completely dark. But there was none to be had, not even a box of matches. The thread and the screwdriver we hid in the duct, a few feet from the entrance. We could only hope they would not be missed, or that if they were, we wouldn't be suspected. Justin and two others were chosen as the exploration party. One of the others was Arthur, whom you've met. They had a terrible time at first. Here was a maze to end all mazes, and in the dark they quickly lost their sense of direction. Still, they kept at it, night after night, exploring the network of shafts that laced like a cubical spider web through the walls and ceilings of the building. They would tie the end of their thread to the grid in our laboratory and unroll it from the spool as they went. Time and time again they reached the end of the thread and had to come back. It just isn't long enough, Justin would complain. Every time I come to the end, I think, if I could just go 10 feet farther. And finally, that's what he did. On the seventh night, just as the thread ran out, he and the other two reached a shaft that was wider than any they had found before, and it seemed, as they walked along it, to be slanting gently upward. But the spool was empty. "You wait here," Justin said to the others. "I'm going just a little way farther. Hang on to the spool, and if I call, call back." They had tied the end of the thread around the spool so they would not lose it in the dark. Justin had a hunch. The air coming through the shaft had a fresher smell where they were, and seemed to be blowing harder than in the other shafts.
Up ahead he thought he could hear the whir of a machine running quietly, and there was a faint vibration in the metal under his feet. He went on. The shaft turned upward at a sharp angle, and then, straight ahead, he saw it, a patch of lighter-colored darkness than the pitch-black around him, and in the middle of it, three stars twinkling. It was the open sky. Across the opening there was, as Jenner had predicted, a coarse screen of heavy wire. He ran toward it for a few seconds longer, and then stopped. The sound of the machine had grown suddenly louder, changing from a whir to a roar. It had obviously shifted speed. An automatic switch somewhere in the building had turned it from low to high, and the air blowing past Justin came on so hard it made him gasp. He braced his feet against the metal and held on. In a minute, as suddenly as it had roared, the machine returned to a whisper. He looked around and realized he was lucky to have stopped. By the dim light from the sky, he could see that he had reached a point where perhaps 24 air shafts came together like branches into the trunk of a tree. If he had gone a few steps farther, he would never have been able to distinguish which shaft was his. He turned in his tracks, and in a few minutes he rejoined his friends. We had a meeting that night, and Justin told all of us what he had found. He had left the thread, anchored by the screwdriver, to guide us out. Some were for leaving immediately, but it was late, and Jenner and I argued against it. We didn't know how long it would take us to break through the screen at the end. If it should take more than an hour or two, daylight would be upon us. We would then be unable to risk returning to the laboratory, and would have to spend the day in the shaft, or try to get away by broad daylight. Dr. Schultz might even figure out how we had gone and trap us in the air shaft. Finally, reluctantly, everyone agreed to spend one more day in the laboratory and leave early the next night. But it was a hard decision, with freedom so near and everyone thinking as I did, suppose Dr. Schultz grew suspicious and put locks on our cages. Suppose someone found our thread and pulled it out. This was unlikely. The near end, tied to the spool, was 6 feet up the shaft, well hidden. Just the same, we were uneasy. Then, just as we were ending our meeting, a new complication arose. We had been standing in a rough circle on the floor of the laboratory, just outside the 2 screen doors that enclosed the mice cages. Now, from inside the cabinet, came a voice. Nicodemus! It was a clear but plaintive call, the voice of a mouse. We had almost forgotten the mice were there, and I was startled to hear that one of them knew my name. We all grew quiet. "Who's calling me?" I asked. "My name is Jonathan," said the voice. "We've been listening to your talk about going out.